Okay. So why don't we should start then? I'll say a few comments also about this conversion thing. So maybe we should start now, and then we'll get into, again, with Tzvi Yehuda Cook. Just a few clarifications. I quoted last week comments by Rav Avadi Yosef about converts who are not the authentic converts, that is, don't follow Torah properly, how if at the time it appeared to the Beis Din that they were valid converts, what happens afterwards is irrelevant. I thought it came from Yabi Omer. Actually, it might be in Yabi Omer, although I don't think so. It's every year, Torah Shabbal Peh. There's a Torah Shabbal Peh convention at Mosad Rav Kook, and Rav Avadia published an essay, and they were all reprinted last year in this book called Masa Ovadia. See, a nice thick book. A number of the things are included in Yabi Omer, and in there he has an essay about Geirus and all the issues of Geirus, and you can see his position on it. I mean, he quotes, for example, Rav Shlomo Kluger, just to give you a sense of what some of these posts came in pre-modern times, I shouldn't say pre-modern, in before the last 30 years, we're discussing. Rav Shlomo Kluger has, I think I have it here somewhere, I can't seem to find it at present, questions such as, a man was with a non-Jewish woman, and he threatened he was going to convert to Christianity unless they convert the woman. And the Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was one of the most extreme of the Machmirim, he decided it's better to convert the woman than have the man convert. You know, it's a busha to the family, we lose the Jew, etc., etc. But you could see the fact that they would even consider converting the woman. We're not dealing with the greatest tzaddikim here. What type of life? So obviously, she agrees to go to the synagogue, and she's not going to go to church anymore, but certainly not the standards one would expect today. I mentioned briefly the Rambam's notion that when you do convert, if it appears that it's not for the right reasons, such as if you convert for marriage, etc., the Rambam says choshishin, that we question this convert, and there's a lot of debate what this means. I'll just call everyone's attention to this book, Giur Uzahut Yehudit, by Avi Sagi and Tzvi Zohar, who discusses this. He actually, their position is that when it says choshishin, this contradicts what the Rambam elsewhere says, that once you convert, it's final. They think it means that you should worry about marrying this person unless you see that they really are have the right purposes in mind. But it's a questionable halacha. Just a few more things briefly on this issue, because a number of you have emailed me about it. European rabbis invalidate Druckmann conversion. So basically, the Conference of European Rabbis announced this week they would not recognize converts who are converted by Rav Druckmann, even though the State of Israel recognizes them. So that's interesting, I think. And most important, and finally on this issue, is that earlier this week, Rav Druckmann was fired by the government. Ostensibly, he was fired because he was 75 years old, and there's a 70-year-old retirement age. Well, that's complete nonsense, because he has been on for all these years. And lots of people in Israel continue on after those ages. Jeff Wolf, on his blog, points out, interestingly, that he thinks the politics are as follows. What, after all, what is Omertz? Why is he's all of a sudden become Haredi, and he's firing Rav Druckmann? He believes that Omertz problems, which are going to be mounting in the coming days, is very important for him. He's not going to have the Zionist religious parties on his side because of his intentions to make movement on the Golan, but he wants to have the Haredi parties, so therefore he fires Druckmann. Now, this is all incredible because the Haredi parties only have 6 seats. I'm not counting Shas here. And the National Religious Party, joined with the National Union, has 9 seats. And if you consider the fact that many religious Zionists vote for Likud and Kadima and others, it's obvious that the religious Zionists are at least double the population, the voting population, of the Haredim. And yet the Haredim seem to have all the cards here. Okay, let us move on. I just want to make 2 more comments when we said last class with regard to questions. I had mentioned quickly that the Russia yeshiva in Europe didn't get involved in politics. That is often the case. That's not always the case. I want to clarify this, as I often do when I make statements. The Mir Russia yeshiva, the Savuk yeshiva, and others did not. But there were some who did. Rav Aaron Cutler, for example, the Kletz Geshiva, was involved in the Agudas Yisrael, as was Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. But that was the case for many of the Rosh Yeshiva. And finally, one more comment about Rav Shach and Kirov, because a number of people emailed me about this. And I'll just say, this is nothing new to Rav Shach. This was the standard, what I'm going to explain again, was the standard Haredi position. And the Brisker Rav himself spoke about this, and others. And when I grew up, this was the position. It's not that Rav Shach is against Kirov. He's not against people becoming religious. That's not what I was referring to. What he was against was an ideal that Kirov is something that everyone should struggle, should focus themselves on, and it should become an organized thing. No. For people in yeshiva, Torah study is what is the organized thing, and that's what they should focus themselves on. And you don't go out and mix with the non-Jewish culture, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't mean that you're not interested in making people religious. But there's a limit, and this was always understood in the Haredi world, in the yeshiva world, until about 20 years ago. That's what he's referring to. The analogy is to chesed. Chesed is important also, but as anyone who's been to yeshivas know, there is no such thing as organized chesed in yeshivas. And I remember when I was in yeshiva, I remember we asked the Rebbe, why don't we devote one day a week to, you know, help the poor or something like that, and that's what he pointed out. And this is certainly the Haredi perspective, that's not what yeshiva bachrim do. You spend your time devoted to Torah study. Other people do chesed. And yes, you have time to do chesed too, on Shabbos, on your free time, at night. Everyone can do acts of chesed. But when you're in the yeshiva, you're supposed to be devoted entirely to learning Torah. That's your job. Not everyone has to do everything. Obviously, other yeshivas disagree, and they devote time to chesed. But in the yeshiva world, you don't devote yourself to chesed, you don't devote yourself to kirov. When you leave the yeshiva, you can, when other people can. So this doesn't mean that he's opposed to people becoming religious, but everything needs to be put into context. Yeshiva bachrim are not supposed to be spending their time doing that. Their primary goal is to learn Torah. Okay, with that, let us move on. We ended last class talking about, beginning with Ritzi Yehuda Cook, and we're going to vote today's class and also next class. To Ritzi Yehuda, and I began by talking about how he was born in 1891. I mentioned that he's the only son of his father, of Avraham, and the second wife. I said that I believe it was Wikipedia that erred on the information of which son he was. It's not. I checked it. It's not Wikipedia. It's actually, there's a doctoral dissertation on Ritzi Yehuda Cook, and they make the mistake. When he was born, and in his early years, Rav Cook was Rav in Lithuania. There was a small town, Zaimo. And in 1904, Rav Cook goes on Aliyah and becomes Rav of Jaffa, Yafo. Now, I'm not going to go through, we had three entire classes on Rav Cook. I encourage everyone who's interested to listen to those. We don't have time to go through those. So we'll just, he comes on Aliyah, is Rav of Jaffa, the new Yishuv there. And Ritzi Yehuda, of course, studies with his father, who was his major teacher, although he did study also in Jerusalem, in a couple different places. Already in his early years, he's very involved in his father's writings. His father allows him to edit his writings. And we know that there were even disputes between father and son. Should something be included? Should something not? We now know, because the manuscripts of Rav Cook's writings have been published in their entirety, I shouldn't say in their entirety, most of them. It's called the Eight Notebooks. And we see now, in a way we couldn't see years ago, how much Ritzi Yehuda was actually involved in editing, even softening certain radical statements. Shortly before World War I, his father tells him, he sends him basically to Germany. He wants to send him outside the land of Israel. It was thought that his father was so involved, and his Ritzi Yehuda was helping his father and everything, there wasn't time for him to learn Torah. He needs to have a few years where he simply is devoted to Torah study, not involved in everything else, what was taking place in the land of Israel. Why not go to the Lithuanian yeshivas? He went to Germany. Why not the Lithuanian yeshivas? I'm not sure why not. Perhaps his father wanted him to broaden. His father sends him to Germany, where he teaches Torah. He becomes a teacher for Jewish high school students. That is, they all went to the regular public schools, but in the afternoon, they would learn every day, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 hours a day, and he was one of their teachers. These were Agudistan. These were Aguda-type high schoolers. And the rest of the time, Ritzi Yehuda focused on Torah study. He went to Halberstadt in Germany because Halberstadt, there was a, the Rav there, was, his name was Isaac Auerbach. And Isaac Auerbach was the brother of a man, Moses Auerbach, who had come, the Aguda had sent him to Israel. He opened up in Petah Tikva a fairly modern Orthodox school system, and that was the connection. In Germany, he also was able, in addition to teaching, where he supported himself and learning, he was able to get an understanding of European Jewry, and that was going to be very important, as we'll see in a few minutes, I guess, with his father and his vision of Judaism, because it, although it was focused in the land of Israel, it was important to spread it to the diaspora as well. In addition, his father wanted him to meet Gedolim, meet great sages, and Europe was full of great sages. Now, we have a letter, a volume of letters, of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. It's called Tzemach Tzvi. It's volume one. It came out about 15 years ago, and it only covers from 1907 to 1919, but it covers a long period, 5 years. Most of the letters are really from that period of when Rav Tzvi Yehuda was in Germany. So we see, really, he's never been in a community. He grew up in a small shtetl in the land of Israel, and now he's exposed to the Torim Derech Eretz Jews of Germany. It's fascinating to read some of these letters. In fact, one of the things that he finds interesting, which Rabbi Chiya Yaakov Weinberg also found interesting, and he writes to his father, is that the women, the girls, they sang Zmirot at the Shabbos table. This was something which wasn't done in Eastern Europe and wasn't done in the land of Israel. It wasn't thought to be modest, to be tznius. And he writes to his father about that. How interesting he finds this. The fact that there would be shows and performances, this sort of thing. This just didn't happen in the traditional world. He writes about how they used to go on tiyulim, tours. You had Jewish scouts. Scouting was a big thing in Germany in those days. And you had Orthodox scouts. I mean, today we have Orthodox Cub Scouts and things like that. He writes about how he went on these great hikes with these kids. And if you know what the Orthodox population was like, we spoke about this in previous lectures, it was very assimilated, much more assimilated even than the Orthodox in America to American culture, American society. They were, I shouldn't say much more, but more. They were so tied to German culture in a way that in America, culture isn't that important. If you're tied to anything, you're tied to fine dining maybe and sports, but the Germanic culture, you know, the fatherland was very important. He writes about how when they would go on their tiyulim, their hikes, they would sing German songs, and this he found very surprising. And he writes to his father how he was able to convince them to sing Hebrew songs, Jewish songs. I mean, the typical German Jewish boy for his bar mitzvah, he wasn't given Sfarim or anything like that. He was given the writings of Goethe and Schiller, things of that nature. In 1920, he returns to the land of Israel, and 2 years later, he's back in Europe. And this time, he's also going into Eastern Europe. He meets many Gedolim, Hasidic Rebbes, Chafetz Chaim. There's famous stories about his meetings with the Chafetz Chaim. He's also spreading his father's idea. His father wanted to form an organization called Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, which would spread his vision of Judaism, his Zionistic vision, but not really Mizrahi. More focused on, I guess you'd call it the Messianic type of approach, or whatever you want to call it. While there, he meets his wife. Chava Hutner is her name, cousin of Rav Yitzchak Hutner, sister of Rav Yehoshua Hutner, if any of you know the name. Yehoshua Hutner, for many years, was the director of the Talmudic Encyclopedia. After Rav Zevin passed away, he still is alive. He is close to 100 years old right now. He actually lives in Rabbi Rakefet's building in Berlin 18. I know that because he often mentions it. From a very important family, obviously, the Hutner family. They never had any children, though, and she would die in 1944, and Rav Yehuda lives on to, I think, 1982. So his students would become his children. Now, Merkaz Harav, the yeshiva Merkaz Harav, no, he never remarried. And he's not the only one. We have other Rabbanim. I mean, you have question, obviously. How could he not remarry? He hasn't fulfilled the mitzvah of Pru Urvu. But we have numerous examples of Rabbanim who, when their wives died, they didn't remarry. And it just they felt that there was no one else for them. Merkaz Harav is founded by Rav Kook in 1924. The idea is to create a new yeshiva, an Eretz Yisrael yeshiva, a yeshiva that's cognizant of the rebuilding of the land, of the time we're living in, the Aliyah, that this is a new era. It's not going to be a yeshiva like the yeshivas of Eastern Europe. Of course, when it's founded, it's not a very big yeshiva. You don't have, people are not coming to the land of Israel to study in it like they study in other places. That was a big disappointment. But it was to be a new type of yeshiva where, for example, the Maharal is studied, Yehuda Levi, much wider curriculum, a different approach. It never really became it in its beginnings, but that was the idea. Who was the Rosh Yeshiva? Rav Kook. He was chief rabbi, very involved, but he also gave the shiurim. No, the name of the yeshiva is actually HaYeshiva HaMerkazit, which is translated on the English stationery as the Universal Yeshiva. After Rav Kook passes away, I don't think it was during his lifetime, it then becomes called Merkaz HaRav. But that's not the name, you know, the center of the Rav, the central yeshiva of the Rav. It was just the HaYeshiva HaMerkazit. Because he wanted it to be a universal yeshiva, where students come from all over the world. He developed ties with Bernard Revel. He wanted to have some involvement with the Yeshiva Shir B'Tzohanan. He wanted people to come from all over the world, and yet the students were literally going hungry. They had no money. The yeshiva was on the verge of closing many times. So Rav Kook was the Rosh Yeshiva. His big student, Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap, was also a Rebbe there, a teacher there. As was Rav Yitzchak Arieli, the famous Einayim LaMishpat, as well as the Nazir. And we're not going to get to the Nazir, I think, this term. We'll get to it the next time. The Rav Arieli was the Mashkiach. It followed certain Musar trends in which there's a Mashkiach. And the Nazir taught philosophy, things like that. When Rav Yehuda returns to the land of Israel, he teaches Tanakh, and also, he didn't call it Hashkafa, at least in later years, he called it Emunah. What we today would call ideology, teaching people, lecturing them on Jewish ideology. He also, in the early years, was in charge of the finances of the yeshiva, and we know that he was a disaster. And we don't just know this from opponents or anything. We actually know it, just to give you one example, Rav Avinair is the first volume of his biography, Tzvi Kodesh, he tells us, Rav Avinair is a great Talmud, a great student. He never would dream of saying anything bad about Ritzi Yehuda. But he says Ritzi Yehuda, his mind was never into practical things like his father. I told you the story about his father, how they used to pay a salary once a week, and after they'd pay it, sometimes poor people would come in, and he just would give them all the money. He had no real concept of money, and then the Revitzin would come in to get the money to go buy the food, and there wouldn't be any money. So they would end up having to pay the salary directly to his wife. Ritzi Yehuda, he did a terrible job. He couldn't raise any money. That some people just don't have that, and therefore his brother-in-law, if I'm not mistaken, Rav Shalom Ra'anan, became head of finances. I guess he did need Rabbi Jay's help. Now, Ritzi Yehuda was not then, and really he wasn't ever. Although maybe I don't think there's any disagreement about this, even if you go into the Merkaz world, although some of the super Hasidim might disagree, but I really don't think there's any disagreement. He was not regarded as qualified to give a shiur in Shas and Poskim. When I say qualified, yes, he was very learned in Shas and Poskim. You can see his notes to Rav Kook's Tshuvot. They have notes to Ritzi, and Rav Zevin points out the great learning. But simply to be a great Talmud Chacham doesn't mean that you're an expert in Shas and Poskim of the sort that you can give shiurim. First of all, we have great Poskim who can't give a shiur. Just like the typical Magid shiur in a yeshiva can't be a Posek. But Ritzi Yehuda, his focus, like you take someone from Rav Dessler. I don't think it's any insult to Rav Dessler to say he was not the person to give a shiur in Shas and Poskim. He obviously was a great scholar in Talmud and things of that, but his focus was on ideological matters. If you take the great Mashgichim, the Altar of Sabbatka, people like that, their role, they don't focus. Whereas someone else spends all their time learning Talmud and halachic literature, some like Ritzi Yehuda, the Altar of Sabbatka, other people like that, they spend most of their time studying the philosophical writings, the Musar text, it's maybe Tanakh, it's just a different focus. So, and this becomes significant later because he's a very unusual Rosh Yeshiva. He's a Rosh Yeshiva who does not give shiur in Talmud, which is very unusual. But so he wasn't one to give a shiur in Shas and Poskim. This makes him different than the other Rosh Yeshiva of his generation. Now, Rav Kook dies in 1935 on the 3rd of Elul, Shoshav Elul. Ritzi Yehuda takes over, Well, I shouldn't say Rav Tzvi takes over. He doesn't take over. First, the yeshiva falls into hard times. It really only begins its revival in the late 50s, early 60s, and we'll get back to that in a little while, and especially with the 67 war. The Rosh Yeshiva officially becomes Rav Charlap. Later on, Rav Charlap, actually, there's two yeshivas. He's involved in another yeshiva. I believe it starts towards the end of his life, Beis Zavul. But Yaakov Moshe Charlap is the Rosh Yeshiva, the official Rosh Yeshiva, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda is his assistant. Although Rav Tzvi Yehuda has an important role because he is the son. He's the one who carries on the name of Rav Kook. But the fact is that from 1935, for the next 20 or so years, Rav Tzvi Yehuda goes into complete obscurity, complete unknown. He still teaches at the yeshiva, but he really is an unknown person. You speak to people from the Merkaz Rav Yeshiva during those years, and even in later years, into the 50s and early 60s, and he's an insignificant figure. He's in charge of some administration. He speaks a little about Hashgafa. And he's devoting himself primarily to editing his father's works. His major job is publishing his father's writings, the letters, the response. He's working on the various works of Orot. He's helping the Nazir on Orot HaKodesh, etc. That's what he's doing. And the yeshiva itself is not a significant institution. Yes, there are great scholars who study there. Rav Yosef Kafach from last semester, he was studied there at that time. But it really is a minor institution. And then comes 1947. You know, the great institutions, especially after the war, you have the Ponevez Yeshiva, the Mir Yeshiva opens up again, Sobuk opens up, and you have other yeshivas, Chevron, the Yeshiva of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Kol Torah opens up. After 67 war. But first we have 1947, 48. The War of Independence, and the state is proclaimed. This should be, for Rav Tzvi Yehuda, the most important day. And yet, he tells us, and we have it in the biographies as well, but he himself does, rather than being out dancing like everyone else, Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Charlap are inside Rav Kook's in the old yeshiva, which is about down by Geula, and they're crying. And this really shows us what's going to become. Because why are they crying? They're crying because a piece of the land has been taken. The night of partition, when the UN voted the partition plan, when everyone was dancing, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, I think it was in November of 1947, Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Charlap are crying because a piece of the land has been cut off. This would become the most important aspect of his worldview. He obviously would later rejoice and see the creation of the state as the greatest achievement in 2,000 years. But his first reaction, his emotional reaction, is one of great sadness. In the early 1950s, Rav Charlap passes away. Incidentally, those who went to YU, Rav Zevulun Charlap, is the grandson of Rav Yaakov Moshe Charlap. Rav Tzvi Yehuda takes over as Rosh Yeshiva. And it's then that Rav Tzvi Yehuda begins to emerge. What happens in the early 1950s? There are a group of young religious Zionist men who want to start learning Torah more intensively than had been the case in the religious Zionist world. And they were attracted to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Actually, they were attracted to the writings of Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, the father. By this time, Orot has been published. The letters have been published. Some of the letters have been published. The first volume. They go to Rav Tzvi Yehuda and they say, we want to study your father's writings and we want you to teach us. And so begins a private circle that comes to Rav Tzvi Yehuda. This is private instruction, not in the yeshiva, although some of them do enroll in the yeshiva. Among these early people were Rav Moshe Levinger, later or today from Chevron, who's very ill. And in later years you get a number of Rav Eliezer Waldman, a number of other important figures join this group where Tzvi Yehuda is instructing them. Until then, until this time in the 1950s, Rav Tzvi Yehuda has no real students. Now he has a cadre. He has a group who want to study about Rav Kook, and they see Rav Tzvi Yehuda as not just an interpreter, they see Rav Tzvi Yehuda as the authorized interpreter. That is, where Rav Tzvi Yehuda explains how Rav Tzvi Yehuda's take on it, that's the emes. And it's not just his interpretations of Rav Kook himself. they're interested in what Tzvi Yehuda has to say, because remember, Rav Kook is writing before the state comes about. He's writing theory. Rav Tzvi Yehuda is taking it into practice. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda becomes the link to Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Kook. At this time, again, let me tell you about the yeshiva. Who's in the yeshiva? You have Rav Shalom Ra'anan. Rav Avraham Shapiro is brought in to give Gemara Shirim. Later, Rav Shaul Yisraeli. That is not Rav Tzvi Yehuda's role, though. He is the Rosh Yeshiva. He sends out letters to Hatzofeh, the Zionist, religious Zionist newspaper. He makes proclamations, things of that nature. But he's not functioning as a typical Rosh Yeshiva. And yet, if there had never been 1967, Rav Tzvi Yehuda would remain like so many other Rosh Yeshiva, so many other thinkers, with small groups. As I said, he is interpreting his father's teachings to small groups of students. But he's not a force. And at the end of the day, he is a minor figure. After all, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kohen Kook is not a popular figure into the 60s. He is not a very important figure. His form of Zionism is not that important. How do we know this? Look at articles. Look at writings. People do not see themselves as followers of Rav Kook. He is thought to be a Luftmensch, a mystic, a tzaddik, a pious one. But he's not like today, the explosion of interest in his writings. By the 1960s, though, the yeshiva had begun to expand. The religious Zionist world was focusing more on Torah study. It moves from the middle of Jerusalem, moves to Kiryat Moshe, to where its building is right now. I encourage everyone to go visit this building. But Rav Tzvi Yehuda is still a minor figure. What is he known for before 67? He's really known for three things. His small group of followers. He's known for his anti-missionary stand. That was during the time when the Christian missionaries were trying to come to Israel. He organized demonstrations. He was very involved in that. And also he was known for his opposition to religious coercion. If you can believe it, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was a member of an organization. The job of it was to prevent religious coercion. There's a lot of religious coercion. The Israeli government passes laws which force non-religious Jews to do things that they don't want to do. Rav Tzvi Yehuda thought that this was all a mistake. He thought that in modern times, the only way you can reach the non-religious is by encouraging them. Yes, he thought that state institutions, you can't have state institutions open on Shabbos. But people's private life, you can't interfere. I don't even think he'd support this chametz law, that you can't sell chametz. That is, you don't force people in their private life. So in that sense, he was significant. Now, civil marriage, he would have supported. Because civil marriage is part of the state. You know, the state, that's part of the structure. Every country has marriage, which the government has to recognize. They hadn't yet reached its place that the state should totally dismantle. He was talking about legislation that affect people in their private life. Today we would say civil marriage is a classic example, but, he wasn't referring to that. He was referring to laws which would tell individuals, if you have private cars, you can't drive them, that sort of thing. Can't open up pools, if you're in private houses, public pools he was very opposed to in Jerusalem. I don't know if it's important to get into the details. I don't know how many details there were, but he was talking about the idea that Torah cannot be something you force down people's throat today, and increasing religious legislation is incorrect. Rav Tzvi Yehuda believed in keeping the status quo. Civil marriage was inherited. It was part of what existed when the state came into being, but not more religious legislation. And that's really all he was known for prior to 67. Everything changes in 67. Of course, the whole religious Zionist world changed in 67. Modern Orthodoxy, the way it is today, would never have developed had it not been for 67. The development of the year in Israel, the Hezji Yeshivas, all of this really come about because of 1967. The Baal Tshuva movement, exactly. The Baal Tshuva movement gives people, non-religious Jews, get enormous pride from what goes on in Israel. And then many of them travel to Israel. Part of the idea of traveling to Israel is going to the Kotel, seeing the wall, this great pride that Jews have. It affects Jews all over the world. We're affected by this in ways that today even we can't begin to understand. By the 1960s, Rav Tzvi Yehuda had this group, this cadre of followers, who were ready to spread a new ideology of Orthodoxy. but until 1967, the country wasn't ready for it. The country needed to see the miracle of 67. The country needed to feel that it was on the cusp of a new era, in fact, in a new era, a messianic era, perhaps, and the feelings that went along with that, in order to be open to Ratzi Yehuda and ultimately Rav Avraham Cook's vision. In fact, by the way, if you speak to people at Merkaz, it's not just the 67 war, which stands out as a great miracle, but there's another miracle, which is just as important and goes along with it. On Yom HaAtzma'ut of 1967, which is, remember, if I have the text here, which is a month before the 67 war, every year Rav Tzvi Yehuda would speak on Yom HaAtzma'ut about how important the state is. And we'll get to some of his philosophy in a few minutes. And in 1967, he gets up. And instead of speaking about how great the state is, he starts screaming, "Where is our Hebron? Where is our Shechem? Everyone is so joyful today, 19 years of a state, and yet how can we rejoice when Jerusalem is not in our hands and Hebron is not in our hands?" He says, until all of Israel is under Jewish sovereignty, we can't have real joy. 3 weeks after this, the war begins, in 6 days, amazing victory. And from the standpoint of his followers, Ratzi Yehuda, if not a real prophet, was certainly speaking with Ruach HaKodesh. And that was also part of the image of Ratzi Yehuda. He was the one who proclaimed that we are missing Chevron, and God responds. Thus begins Gush Emunim, the settlement movement. Thus begins the notion, the idea of greater Israel, that it's a mitzvah to settle the entire land of Israel. Whereas Shai Leibovitz, as soon as the Six-Day War was over, he declared, now's the time to make peace and give back this land. And there are many in the religious Zionist world who were afraid to keep all this land. After all, you have all these Arabs, maybe we can give it back and make peace. And Ratzi Yehuda immediately declared, God has given us this land. No one has the authority, the right to give it back. We must now settle this land. The state of Israel was step one in the Messianic era. Step two is conquering the land. The prophecies are coming about. They're being fulfilled in our lifetime. We are seeing prophecies with our very eyes. The leadership of Merkaz HaRav almost entirely came. The leadership of Gush Emunim was almost entirely a product of Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva. And we could have an entire class on the achievements, the ideology of Gush Emunim, but I just want to stick to Ratzi Yehuda, because while his ideology is central to Gush Emunim, and of course we'll talk about this, that's what's most important. That's why, as we saw last class, he was voted seventh most important figure in the history of Israel. There really is a lot more to Ratzi Yehuda than just Gush Emunim. But it was after 67 that his ideology is able to emerge on the scene, and that's when his great spiritual power is seen. Now when Ratzi Yehuda speaks, people come and listen. You can have thousands of people come to hear him. His talks, his lectures, are now being mimeographed and passed out, not just in America, in Israel, all over the world. This new ideology, that the young people especially feel it, that now is the chance to settle this land. We have a great victory. The Haredi Rabbanim, they have no attachment to the religious Zionist youth. The religious Zionist youth are looking for spirituality. They're looking for a Rebbe. And where is that Rebbe? It's Ratzi Yehuda. Because Ratzi Yehuda is there validating their life, validating their lifestyle, validating their dreams from a Torah perspective. He becomes, in every sense of the word, a Hasidic Rebbe. Although he is an opponent of Hasidus, and we'll speak about why he opposed Hasidus. This is one of the big differences between him and his father. He becomes a Rebbe. His followers relate to him no different than the Hasidic Rebbe, even to the extent of seeing him as a miracle worker. He gave Das Torah. He told people what to do, and although he says he doesn't give Das Torah, every word of his was Das Torah. If you ever speak to people from Merkaz, you can't say something to them like, well, maybe Ratzi Yehuda was wrong about this or that. It's incomprehensible. So he is their rabbi. Messianism is in the air. And he assumes enormous importance. It was Ratzi Yehuda that was fearless. he begins speaking about tzaddikim. There's a passage in the Talmud that speaks about tzaddikim who don't believe. There's tzaddikim who don't believe. What does that mean, tzaddikim who don't believe? Tzaddikim, when I say tzaddikim, because they're righteous people, they follow the Torah and mitzvot, but they don't see God's hand. And he applies this to the rabbis in his own day. Who are the tzaddikim who don't believe? The Haredi rabbis. Of course, they're tzaddikim, the Talmid Chachamim, but they don't see with their own eyes. They don't believe. They do not believe in God's providence. God has given us this land. He sent all these miracles, and they continue acting like they're living in the Golos. So these are the tzaddikim who don't believe. He begins speaking about the holiness of the Israeli army. Tzavah Israel, Tzahal, is Kodesh. It's holy. I mean, some people are afraid of this. Is this fascism? I mean, whoever heard? No, Rasula says. This is King David's army. This is the way we're supposed to live. 2,000 years we lived in Golis. We didn't have an army because we weren't permitted to have one. Now we're returning to the way things should be. The state of Israel is a vital part of the Messianic redemption. So these Haredi rabbis, these tzaddikim who don't believe, they look at the state and they see the secularists and they see all the problems, but they don't see God's providence. They don't see that the state is God's tool for creating the Messianic era. And there's so many sources that could be cited about how the Messianic era begins small and then grows. In fact, what Tzvi Yehuda says is not, we're not in the beginning of the redemption. The beginning of the redemption happened when they started resettling the land at the early part of the 20th century. We're now in the antechamber. The passage has begun. We're already, the ship has left the docks. We're in the midst of the Messianic era. The beginnings, of course. But we are in the midst. And we must not do anything to stop it. This is why everything he says becomes so important, not to have faith. Because we are in the Messianic era. And any talk about returning land, about going backwards, shows that we're rejecting God's promise. And we do not see, we become tzaddikim, we don't believe. We don't see that God has set into motion the Messianic era. And all we have to do is have faith. The NRP, the National Religious Party, that ran religious Zionism until 67, was a very liberal, left-wing type of religious party, and that, when it came to settlements and things like that, they were, some of them were even, you call them peaceniks or pacifists, they were very far removed from this. They were the Rav Soloveitchik, Mizrahi, Rav Reines type of Zionism. And here Rav Tzvi Yehuda is preaching a messianic type of Zionism, one which is not concerned with realpolitik, one which is not concerned with coalitions or things like that, one which is concerned with speaking the truth. And that, by the way, I think became a feature when Rav Tzvi Yehuda's followers took over the Maftal, the religious Zionists. This became a feature. Land became the most important thing, and ideals. I mean, if you look at the Haredi religious parties, and this goes back to what I said at the very beginning. What's Omer? Why does he need the support of the Haredi? Because the Haredi religious parties, and this is, they acknowledge it themselves. They are for sale to the highest bidder. They don't have any ideology that they're pushing. The highest bidder is the one that will provide the most money for the yeshivas and keep the status quo on issues relating to the Haredi community. There's Shabbos in the public sphere, etc., etc. And they'll go with Labor, they'll go with Likud, they are for sale, whoever will give them the best deal. The Gush Emunim types, the Maftal, or Tzvi Yehuda's followers, there's no deals. There's the ideology of the complete land of Israel, and that's who they will go with, and they can't be bought. So you could say that's good, or that's bad, because if you have such a stringent ideology, you're always going to be in the opposition to, and even when you're in the government, you're always going to be disappointed. Politics, you need to compromise. Yes, this has had a terrible impact, and we'll get to that. Religious Zionism, we spoke about this with Cook. It's become focused just on the land, and religious Zionism is supposed to speak for all religious Jews, and there's terrible social problems in Israel. You have poverty, you have all sorts of things. You have environment, you have all these issues that people want to know. What does religion say about the environment, about low wages, about stuff that goes on in Postville, Iowa, with agriprocessors? I mean, all the OU can say is that, well, that's not our concern. You know, many people say that's not enough. In Israel, you have this group, Tzohar, that says, which is a response to the extreme focus on the land, that religion has to speak on all these issues. that has been one of the problems we'll get to. Ritz Yehuda came out summer of 67 with a famous document. Lo Taguru! Here's the document with Ritz Yehuda. This is a booklet. Eretz Hatzvi, Rabbeinu, his fights for the complete land of Israel. And do not be afraid. It talks about how it's even the thought of giving up any land is a terrible sin, that you'll be called to account. And he sends his students to settle the land. And if you look in any of the books from Ritz Yehuda, you see pictures of him visiting these settlements. This, to him, is vital for Judaism. God has given us the land. The problem is as follows. If you don't settle the land, it shows that you're not a complete Jew, as I'll speak about in a minute. You're just a Golus Jew. You think that it's enough to be Jewish, to observe Torah and mitzvahs, just stay at home? No, we must return to the way things were in the days of the Temple, which means we must settle the incomplete land. We must build farms there. We must build it up, because a complete people has to have a land. So you're going to say, maybe, well, why the whole? Who says you need the whole land? Part of the land? Well, if you know the Ramban's understanding, if you know Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook's understanding, the land is vital. The land isn't just something that helps us achieve certain mitzvot, to follow Shemitah, things like that. The land is connected to our soul. It's a very strong form of nationalism. He was even able to explain the purpose of the Holocaust along these lines. And here I'm going to tell you something. I wasn't going to say this week. I was going to say it next week. But for those, especially in America, who've been following this controversy with John Hagee, I think you're going to find what I say now very interesting. For those who don't know, the Canadians, John Hagee is a preacher, a pastor, who was a McCain backer, and he said something, which I don't know why they got so crazy about, everyone got so angry. I'll read you what he said. He gave a very interesting drasha. He was picking up on the words in Jeremiah chapter 16, where God says, I'm going to send many fishers, I'm going to send hunters, and they're going to hunt them, that is the Jews. And then it's speaking about how this is the era when the Lord, as the Lord liveth, that brought up the children of Israel from the lands of the north, I will bring them back to their land. And Jeremiah is speaking about how God is going to bring the children of Israel back to their land, but you're going to have all these hunters who are trying to destroy them. And Hagee gave a speech, a sermon. I mean, it's like an Orthodox sermon, the way he uses the verses, that this refers to the Nazis. The Nazis are the hunters. And, well, let me read it to you. And they, the hunters, should hunt them. That will be the Jews. From every mountain and from every hill and from out of the holes of the rocks. If that doesn't describe what Hitler did in the Holocaust, you can't see that. And then he goes on and talks about Theodor Herzl. And then he says, then God sent a hunter. A hunter is someone with a gun, and he forces you. Hitler was a hunter, and the Bible says, Jeremiah writing, they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and from the holes of the rocks, meaning there's no place to hide. And that might be offensive to some people, but don't let your heart be offended. I didn't write it. Jeremiah wrote it. It was the truth, and it is the truth. How did it happen? Because God allowed it to happen. Why did it happen? Because God said, my top priority for the Jewish people is to get them to come back to the land of Israel. In other words, the Holocaust was God's way of getting the Jews out of Europe to the land of Israel. Now, this became, if you follow the American news, a huge issue. I think also the media was trying to, you know, after focusing so much on Jeremiah Wright, they figure they have to focus on McCain's pastor. Although, look, I personally never liked these theodicy people who think that they can explain why all these things happen. But if you're going to pick out Hagee, we have plenty of rabbis in our camp who can tell you why hurricanes happen and why wars happen and why all these things. And at the end of the day, it's not an anti-Semitic guy. You should have seen, if you go on YouTube, you can see Hagee's, where he retracts his endorsement so as not to cause McCain trouble. You have this rabbi with a long black beard and big black yarmulke standing next to him. In any event, certain people were offended. I get the sense it's people who have no conception of God's involvement in the world who were more offended. They weren't offended, I think, by the theodicy. They were, that is, that he thinks that he knows God's mind. I think they were offended by the very concept that God could have involvement. In any event, why is this relevant? Hagee doesn't know this. No one seems to know this. But Ritz Yehuda said the exact same thing. He said the exact same thing 20 and 30 years ago. Listen to this. I'll read it in English. I'll read a section in Hebrew too. Ritz Yehuda on Yom HaShoah two different times gave a sicha, and he says, well, let me read a little Hebrew for those who know it. Am Yisrael Nalkach נחתך מעומק הגלות על מדינת ישראל. שפיכות הדמים של ששת מיליונים, זה חיתוך ממשי בגוף הלאומי. He goes on how Israel was taken, cut off from the Galut to the land of Israel. Why? Why was this done by the Mashritim, the killers, Yimach Shemam? Am Hashem kol kach davak b'tumat Eretz Ha'amim. The land, I'll say it like a preacher. The people of God was so attached to the impurity of the nations, the land of the nations. Ad shehu mukrach l'yichatech l'yigazer mimenu b'shvichut damim k'shemagiyah. Eight cakes. They were so attached to the land that the only way to get them away from the comfortable diaspora, Germany, Poland, Russia, wherever they were living, was to bring a Holocaust that would completely get rid of them. And Ratzila goes on. He says as follows, that this was Tipul Elohi Pnimi, Amok V'Nisar, Shal Hitarut Mitumazo, Shal Hagalut. God's hidden actions come to bring purity from the impurity of the galut. Mituach Eloki Elohi Achzari Kedei Lahalotam Eretz Yisrael Baal Korcham. It was God's surgical action, a cruel Achzari. Why? In order to bring them out of the land of Israel against their will. In other words, God's providence permits Adolf Hitler to do this because the galus needs to be destroyed. And the only way people will come to the land of Israel is when they recognize there is no more room in the galus. Israel is being created. This must come about through a terrible dialectic of destruction on the one hand and renewal on the other hand. Ratzila sees the terrible destruction of the Holocaust. The only explanation he can give, after all, for the critics, I guess, Hagee, he'd say, well, it just happened. For Ratzila, nothing just happens. Why does God permit the Holocaust? God permits it because it's time for the galus to come to an end. Jews are attached to the lands in the diaspora. They need to be uprooted. That is exactly what Hagee said. I'm not saying I agree with the Yehuda either. But the fact is, Rabbi Yehuda Cook develops, and not just him, his followers, the whole theme, that the only way, just like the destruction of the Second Temple was God's curse, but it was necessary, for the further development of Judaism, things had declined so terribly, it needed to have a new beginning. So too, when we return to the land of Israel, we need a new beginning. And this, unfortunately, was the way it had to come about. That is Rav Tzvi Yehuda's theology. Okay, so Rabbi Kalman, that's interesting. But I'm not sure about your first point.
In the paper here, you know, with the Israel at 60, all the articles, so in the one of the papers, somebody from Israel was writing what a huge mistake it is to tie in the rise of Israel, you know, to aftermath of the Holocaust. I said, A, it's wrong. A, thinks Israel would have happened a much stronger country anyway without the Holocaust. But B, you know, this whole notion, and why should the Palestinians have to suffer because of the sins of the Christians in Europe?
Okay, well, it's the second point, perhaps, but I think the first point is incorrect. Does anyone have any doubt that had there not been a Holocaust, how many people would have come? Who came to Israel? In 1948, there was only 600,000, and that was after the Holocaust. Most of the Jews in Germany would have stayed in Germany. The Jews in Russia would have remained in Russia, obviously. I can't imagine who would have come. Look today, who comes to Israel? Almost all the people in Israel are those who came because they were forced to come, refugees from Europe or from the Arab world. Aliyah, as an ideological motive, accounts for a very small percentage of people in Israel. So, and Ratzvi Yehuda's point is that the people would not come on their own. They needed to be forced to come here, Baal Karcham, because on their own they never would have seen how dangerous it is, the assimilation and the terrible things. You disagree with that, Rabbi Kalman? You think that Israel would have had the numbers it had? The people would have come on their own? Germany was a wonderful place to live.
The fact that we had Israel, you know, in 48, 3 years later, is connected. But the point is, the infrastructure of the Zionist movement in creating a state was established well before the Holocaust, and had that not happened, it may have happened later, but it would have happened in a different way, and perhaps a much stronger country, because we would have had millions of Europeans to draw upon as the Zionist movement got stronger. Remember, the British weren't allowing any Jews in, had the white paper. So, you know, it's obviously there is a connection in terms of the UN, but in terms of the fact that there wouldn't have been a state of Israel, that's hard to say. We could have had a...
No, no, there would have been a state, because Britain was moving out. They moved out of India. They shed all their colonial places in the 1960s. So, yes, they would have left Palestine, if not in the 50s, certainly by the 60s. And there would have been a state of Israel, presumably, because the Arab population wasn't that large either. Question is, what type of numbers would it have been? In any event, Ritzi Yehuda does not even refer to that. Ritzi Yehuda is explaining why the Holocaust comes about. In other words, he could throw up his hands and say, I don't know, like Rav Soloveitchik. Why does God permit it? Rav Yehuda doesn't think that way. From his perspective, the Holocaust comes, this isn't justified, this isn't saying that it's a good thing, but if we want to know why this happens, it happens because the Golus needs to be completely destroyed, the people on their own did not go on Aliyah, God needs to destroy the Golus. And this is a traditional perspective, in that we usually speak about because of our sins these things happen. And some have said because of Zionism, others have said because they didn't go on Aliyah. Ritzi Yehuda says he goes with the Eima Banim Smecha, because Jews did not respond to the call of Aliyah earlier. And therefore, it was time. Your other point is also, look, yes, Israel is... but at the end of the day, the Palestinians are always going to say they're paying for Europe's sins. But the fact is that... Jews had been going on Aliyah. More Jews would have come on Aliyah if it wasn't for the white paper, and there would have been a state. But I think it's interesting, though, that in all this talk this week, on all the news about Hagee, we have a very respected figure in our community who said the exact same thing. And I don't know if anyone, I don't know how offended people are. After all, as I said, we have Rav Shach giving his reasons that we saw last week, and other Rabbanim give, everyone has reasons. So, but next week at the Shabbos table, you can point out what Ritzi Yehuda says. Okay, getting back to Ritzi Yehuda. In these first years following the 67 war, the National Religious Party, a change begins to happen. And certainly by the 1980s, it has been completely swallowed up by the messianic visionaries of Ritzi Yehuda. And Ritzi Yehuda was asked, why are you getting involved in politics? Because I have a whole book here. And I'll get to this book later. Hilchot Tzibur, a new concept. Has anyone ever heard the expression Hilchot Tzibur? There's halachas about lots of things, but halachas about Tzibur. This entire book consists of his letters, his public proclamations, telling the Israeli government what they must do and must not do. And some of the best ones deal with Kissinger. This is during the 70s. Kissinger is coming to Israel a lot. He doesn't refer to Kissinger by name. He calls him Bal Goya, the intermarried guy. I didn't know Kissinger was intermarried, so I assume he... and you should not listen to this pressure, the pressure from the Bal Goya coming over. What are Hilchot Tzibur? Hilchot Tzibur are the halachas that apply to politics. And he was asked, and he gave many interviews on this, why should a rabbi be involved in politics? And here's the book dealing with all of his political interviews, etc. He says as follows, I don't ask anyone's permission. Hapolitika shakai Yisrael hi Torah. The politics of the Jewish people is Torah. Hi kedosha. So from his job, he says that rabbis must be got on politics because you can't distinguish between politics and Torah. So really, this is no different than the Haredi perspective, that everything really comes back to Torah. Now, for Ritzi Yehuda, in the land of Israel, being a religious Jew is not simply studying Torah, as I said. You must work to create a nation. Jews have once again returned to the world stage. Miracles have been done in our behalf. Ritzi Yehuda distinguishes between the government, which he would criticize mercilessly, every government he would criticize mercilessly, and the state itself, which is holy. In fact, it's interesting. In one of the volumes I have, there's a letter from him to Ariel Sharon, who at that time was a general, praising Ariel Sharon as the great Ariel Sharon. There's a note in it saying that this is before Ariel Sharon, you know, changed his tune and became, you know, a disbeliever in our vision. Now, for Ritzi Yehuda, to live in the land of Israel doesn't just mean to study Torah. You can't be a religious Jew in the land of Israel and just study Torah. You must also work to create a nation. As I said, Ritzi Yehuda distinguishes between the government, which is criticized, and the state, which is holy. And if you look at his followers, they do the same thing today. Look at what the state is doing. It's doing all these things, which from their perspective is terrible. Uprooting settlements, things. The state is never the problem. It's the government that's the problem. The state remains holy. The structure of the state is kedusha, is holiness. The governments are impure. So, if the government does something bad, you oppose the government, obviously. But the state itself, you always celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut, things like that. And even if the government does things, you must listen to the government, even though you know they're wrong. So, for because the government is the representative of the state, which is holy, even if the government is incorrect. So, for example, he sent his students to establish settlements. The government would send soldiers to take down the settlements. Rav Tzvi said, you cannot resist. We'll get back to what happened a couple years ago in a few minutes. He said, you cannot resist because the army is holy. The army is the institution of the state. The state is the melech. Even if the king does something wrong, we still have to show kavod malchut, kavod of that you give to the kingship, to the police, to the soldiers, etc. The office of the prime minister must always be given respect. The prime minister is the representative of the Jewish people, even if the holder of this office is a manuvel, is an impure person, a scoundrel. You have to distinguish between the person and the office, and it's not always, therefore, it's Sihuda who tried to show his followers how you protest, how you distinguish between the office and the individual. There was a great dispute, though, among Rav Tzvi's followers, I should mention, about how to respond to Gush Katif. You had one school led by Rav Tau, Rav Shlomo Avinair, and others. The Merkaz Rav Yeshiva split a few years back. Hopefully next class I'll speak about this, because it really, the split comes about how to understand the legacy of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. One school, the Yeshiva Har HaMaor, believes that you cannot resist, the state is holy, even when the state makes, the government makes mistakes, we must show respect for it. And then you had Rav Avram Shapiro in his school, in Merkaz Rav, that believes, first of all, there's a difference when Rav Yehuda was speaking about Yamit. He said, we don't protest because the people are not with us. You know, we see, Rav Yehuda said that if the people are with us, then we can have, you know, certain silent protests. But when the people aren't with us, you certainly can't go against the state. Rav Avram said, and others, that there's a difference between Yamit and Sinai and Yehuda and Shomron, which are in the middle of the land of Israel. And they also said that there's a difference when you see the government is intent on completely uprooting. It's one thing when you have a government which basically is a good government, that you know, Menachem Begin's government, but makes a mistake here and there. Yamit was one of them. Okay, but when you have a government that sets, you know, on its horns that it's going to destroy greater Israel, even Rav Tzvi Yehuda would not say that you have to show respect for this type of government. But that was a dispute among the followers. Yamit. Sinai was occupied by Israel in 67, and they established, they didn't establish much there because it's desert. They had some oil, but down, there was one area in the water by the, at the south called Yamit, which became a big resort, and there was a settlement there, religious Jews lived there, and that was given back to Sinai. And when that was given back to Sinai, you had many people that went to Yamit. It was just like with Gaza. I know someone who went. They sealed it off, but you had ways to get in, and they protested, and the government had to physically, you know, tear down, these shacks they put up, and physically take people away and arrest them because they refused, just like in Gaza, to leave. And at that time, Rav Tzvi Yehuda was almost at the end of his life. It was the last year of his life, and they asked him before Yamit was actually taken down, but when the protest began, and he said that the people were not with us, because the population of Israel as a whole thought that the peace treaty with Egypt was worth it. And every poll showed the majority of Israelis believed in giving back Israel, and Yamit, though, became the symbol, because there they had created a beautiful community, and they had to give it back for peace, and they thought it was worth it. And Rav Tzvi Yehuda said that, the people are not with us, we should not protest. So, do you apply Yamit then, when they're giving away in Yehuda and Shomron, and when they're giving away in Gaza, which is so much closer? That was the big debate between Rav Tau's faction and Rav Shapiro's faction. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, we have 2 more minutes. Rav Tzvi Yehuda broke with the Haredim in other areas. Sherut Leumi, Girls National Service, which the Haredim do not permit. Rav Tzvi Yehuda said that girls are obligated to go to this national service, which means they work in hospitals and do other things. Instead of army service, they do 2 years of national service. And he was asked, it's recorded in one of the books I have, how can you advocate the Sheret Lami, this national service, when the Gedolim oppose it? And they did. The Haredi Gedolim were united in opposition. Rasuda said, I don't know about Gedolim. I know about the Rambam and the Gemara. And the Rambam and Gemara says that in a Mechamet Mitzvah, in an obligatory war, even women must be involved. And obviously, and he points out the Radbaz there says women don't fight. It means that they assist. How do they assist? Today they assist in national service. Yes, the chief rabbis as well. A lot. I don't know about the chief rabbis. Rav Unterman was not opposed to it, Sher Lomi. Rav Herzog was intent at first to come out in support of it, but when he saw the opposition, he too said it was in opposition to it. And I don't know about Rav Uziel. But yes, the chief rabbis, Rav Unterman, though, did support it. His opponents and his relationship, by the way, with the Haredi Gedolim suffered. There were some he was friendly with, Rechazkel Sarna, Rechazkel Abramsky, but others were very opposed to him. They began to call him Tzvika. Tzvika, short for Tzvi Yehuda Cook, just like they would call Rav Soloveitchik J.B. We'll stop here, though. When I get to next class, though, I'm going to show you something very interesting, which relates to some of these things. I have here a secret document. What I'm holding in my hands, just to whet your appetite, to get everyone back next to you. It's not found in any library in the world, in Israel or America. It was immediately withdrawn from circulation. I got a copy, maybe I'll tell you the story, by Rav Avram Shapiro. It's talks and comments of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook on issues of the day, including things about the Chazon Ish and others. I quoted it in my essay on Nathan Kamenetsky's book. I quoted a bit in my new book. As far as I know, this is the only time it's ever been quoted. I don't think there's more than 10 people in the world who have this secret scroll, I think you could say, from the school or Tzvi Yehuda. I shouldn't say, no, there must be more than 10. It was published, and then immediately Rav Avram Shapiro said that it must be recalled. I'll explain to you next week why he said that. And only a few people, maybe only 10, 20, have it. But from this, you really get a sense, first of all, why Rav Avram Shapiro felt it had to be recalled. But second of all, what Rav Tzvi Yehuda, some of his ideas were that Rav Avram thought they were too radical to let out. So instead, the censored version of this was published, and the whole second section was cut out. So those who want to hear some of Rav Tzvi Yehuda's secret thoughts will be here next week, which is the last class, because I go to Israel after that, and we couldn't continue on further this semester. So we'll end here if you have questions. And for those who came late, very exciting. Next Tuesday night at 9:30, Torah in Motion's putting on. You see the figures, the rabbis Adlerstein, Farber, Freundel, and Lau, speaking about the conversion controversy that's taking place in Israel. And with all the heat going on, maybe some clarity will be brought to the issue. Just like the Haredis. Well, what I'm going to speak about next week is the development of Chardal. Chardal really is very much like Haredi, it's just they have a different ideology. And Rav Avram thought that this was the time, the generation is not yet ready for what Tzvi Yehuda said. But I think you'll, after I tell you what some of the things he said, you'll understand. Rav Tzvi Yehuda did not have any correspondence, as far as I know, or interaction with Rav Soloveitchik. However, Rav Tzvi Yehuda criticizes Rav Soloveitchik very strongly. And in this book, and a public proclamation, and I'll get to that next week, it has to do with an interview Rav Soloveitchik gave Tat Sofet, in which Rav Soloveitchik expressed his form of Zionism. And I'll tell you what Rav Tzvi Yehuda said, not just about Rav Soloveitchik, but about the Lubavitcher Rebbe as well. Strong stuff. So they certainly did not see eye to eye. In any event, Rav Soloveitchik never had any appreciation for Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. He was asked, did he ever read Rav Cook? He said he tried to read it, and he couldn't understand what he's talking about. He knew he's a tzaddik. Rav Tzvi Yehuda, his vision of Judaism is so different. And you're in Israel, David, you know. Try to contrast the Rav Aaron Lichtenstein vision of Judaism with any of the Merkaz HaRav Rabbanim vision of Judaism. When I was in yeshiva, I was in the Merkaz HaRav type yeshiva, we were told that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is not a religious Zionist. What does that mean? Yes, he's religious and he's a Zionist, but he's not a religious Zionist because his Zionism is simply a political Zionism and has nothing to do with his religiosity. So you get a sense, and that's, you know, and he's more of a Zionist than the Rav ever was. So you get a sense of where they're coming from. The Rav quoted him on Shiurim. It's interesting. I assume he probably just quoted him in generalities. I have no knowledge of wherever he quoted him actually by text. And he, when the Rav went to Israel in 1935, he met with Ruchuk. But to actually quote him on the text, well, if you can find some, please send them to me, because the Rav said that, you know, he can't understand the Oroch. He doesn't know what he's trying to get at. And obviously, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, in his famous shiur on Shlichut. Okay, tell us about this. I'm unaware of. I just know what's in print.
If you want to try your mic, you can hit the transmitter and have it speak up.
No, you can hit your mic. Okay, the first essay in Maisy Caron. I'll read it. I'll look at it. But again, I'd like to know if he actually quotes a text or he's just quoting Rav Cook in terms of generalities. I'll take a look at that. His Siddur. Yes, I remember now. I remember that. Yes, he does quote the Siddur. The Siddur is Olat Re'iyah, published by Ritzi Yehuda. So he quotes the Siddur. Okay, there's an example. If there's any others, I would be interested to know. I'm unaware of anything in the numerous writings that he quotes. Carmi, I believe, is the one who mentions that he was asked about Rav Cook's writings. What I think the Rav would say is it's not in his tradition, just like he said about the Maharal. It's another famous time he was asked, I think it was the summer shearing, the Yachei Kala, someone tried to ask him something about the Maharal that disagreed with what he said, and he said he doesn't need to reply about the Maharal. The Maharal is not part of our tradition, it's not in my tradition. That is, from his grandfather, they didn't do the Maharal. The Meiri also, yes, the Meiri is not in his tradition. But in terms of Ritzi Yehuda, I'm unaware of any, although there are many students of the Rav who, when they came to Israel, became very close to the Merkaz world. I've mentioned this a number of times, how the Zionism, the religious Zionism that comes from Israel, including the Merkaz Arav type of Zionism, becomes much more significant and influential than the Rav Cook's than the Rav Lively's Zionism. Next time you're in Cedarhurst, or Teaneck, or any place like that, look at how many cars have bumper stickers that say Chevron and things like that. And as I've said before, the people in Chevron would rather they're living in Chevron and have Teaneck bumper stickers. But that's another issue. All these bumper stickers, these Chevron, the Young Israel movement becomes a Chardal Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook type of movement when they go to all these groups. All these people in America who identify with Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, they're not following Rav Soloveitchik, they're following Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. So Rav Tzvi Yehuda is more influential for religious Zionism in America than the Rav, than anyone else. That's the form. Next time you're in your modern Orthodox shul, listen to the politics of the people there. And that's Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. That's not Rav Soloveitchik. Yeah, I think Rabbi Kelman is correct that it was lost to the Mesorah for many years. When you say methodological, I'm not sure what you mean methodological. He also made comments in the Shiur. Sometimes he'd make negative comments about the Meiri, like he didn't regard. I have it from people that he said regarding the Meiri that not everyone who lived in medieval times is really a Rishon. What that means is that the Meiri does not have the status of a Ramban or the Rambam, and there also is this big idea that it's not part of the tradition. It's not just the Chazon Ish said that this is not part of the writings. When you said he wanted to read the originals, I don't know, when you say the originals, what do you mean the originals? Okay, but the Meiri also gives interpretations. He doesn't just bring down everyone else. The fact is the Rav, the Meiri brings down others. Okay, I don't know, the Meiri offers his own perspective on many issues. The Rav didn't think the Meiri was...
If the Shita Mekubetu could be accepted, the Meiri could too, right? I think you're right. The Rav did not consider the Meiri on the level of some of the other Rishonim.
It's not just the Rav, by the way. Rakefa tells a story about Revolk when the Meiri and Bava Basra came out. If you remember the old Meiri and Bava Basra, it's like this the thick. They showed it to Revolk, and Revolk starts screaming that we didn't have the Meiri and tells we don't need to have it now. Remember, the Meiri only comes on the scene I mean, you had passages quoted in the Shita Mikvetzes, but the Meiri, its writings are only published beginning in, really, in the 1950s and on, or maybe the 40s, the early volumes, so it's not part of the Masorah, per se. But it could also be the Meiri, the Rav also made a comment once, a negative comment, that the Meiri can't keep the people's names straight. You know, the Meiri, for those who learn, know that the Meiri calls people by different names, and it's hard to keep track. I mean, some of them are, it's obvious who the Rambam is and the Raiva, but other times he seems to go back and forth, and the Rav once made a negative comment that the Meiri can't keep his, the pseudonyms, the titles he gives these people straight, and no one to this day knows why the Meiri couldn't call the Rambam, and the Raiva, and everyone else. Yeah, the Rav didn't quote the Shita. Okay, the Rav, we all know the Briskers, that's a good point Bill makes, Briskers have a very limited library. A very limited circle of writings. Certainly they don't read the Meiri. I mean, they don't read the Acharonim, except for limited ones, the Minchas Linuch, the Ketzos, and even among Rishonim, they have a limited library. All these Rishonim that are published every day today. I'll conclude with this, unless there's any other questions. And this tells it all, and Rakefet wrote about this in The Last Tradition. Shaul Lieberman got together with Lieberman once at a... It was a bris, and I believe I know which bris it was, because I can't imagine how many brises were the Rav and Lieberman together at. I mean, how many people would the Rav think it's important enough to go to a bris and Lieberman? Well, Arthur Hyman, Professor Arthur Hyman, he told me, and this is just talking about something else entirely, but he mentioned to me that Lieberman and the Rav were both at his son's bris. So, I mean, I can't imagine that there's more than five other people who they both would have been at. The story is as follows. Lieberman said to the Rav that they just found in some Geniza a view of the Gaonim. There's a view of one of the Gaonim that says we all know that Kohanim are Musar, that they're commanded not to come into contact with dead bodies. That's halacha, we all know that. But there is a Gaon who had a position that Kohen can't even come into contact with a sheretz, with certainly an animal, but even a rat or a lizard or just any dead, anything dead the Kohen needs to keep away from. So the Rav, he heard this, he's like, what kind of a shita is this? And the Rav asked Lieberman, do you take this seriously? And Lieberman said, yes, you know, this is obviously a different tradition here. And, you know, our tradition, the standard tradition, the one that's Paschal Halacha, is that a Kohen is only forbidden to come into contact with dead body humans. But this Gaon is reflecting a different tradition, and the Rav said, he asked Lieberman about this certain scholar that he knew Lieberman didn't think highly of, what Lieberman thinks of him, and Lieberman, you know, of course, said, he's an ignoramus, etc. So the Rav replied, do you think ignoramuses only are something we have today? In medieval times and Gaonic times, there were also ignoramuses. So not every Gaon was a great Talmud Chacham. This Gaon was one of the ignoramuses. He wrote down his Torah. We've now discovered it. So he, too, is an ignoramus. And Rav Schechter quotes, Nefesh HaRav, quotes the Rav as saying about this story, which is, Rekheva doesn't quote this, Rav Schechter quotes it, that my grandfather knew how to learn better than a lot of these Gaonim. Yes, when he says Rav Haigon, Rav Shira Gaon, they were big Gaonim. But a typical Gaon, just because you find something written 1,000 years ago, big deal. My grandfather could learn better than him. So it's really a little jarring. I mean, we have this idea that everyone who lived in medieval times was given such great respect, and the Rav says you had ignoramuses in medieval times too. Was it Orbach? I don't think so, because Lieberman got along with Orbach, and he respected Orbach. It probably was someone like Bialoblotsky, if you know Shmuel Bialoblotsky, there are some others. Or Zeitlin. Zeitlin, yes, go to Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, and you see what Lieberman thinks of Zeitlin. But that's a perfect example where the Briskers didn't have so much respect. Just because you lived in medieval, as the Rav said, just because you lived in medieval times doesn't make you a Rishon. Okay, any other comments?
We'll let you go at 10:15. So we'll see you next week, and thank you very much again. And everybody have a good week and a good night. Thank you.
Okay, before. One more thing, I see Bill, just his comment here about you were in Shir when Zeitlin came to the Rav. Very interesting. I didn't know that Zeitlin had any contact with the Rav. You know, Zeitlin taught at YU. It wasn't YU then, it was Yeshiva College. He taught at Teachers Institute. And if you look at the biography of Revel, you see there he discusses, or Kevin discusses, the conflict. Because Zeitlin was putting forth radical views and the Rosh Yeshiva couldn't handle it. So he had a connection there, but I had no idea that he had any involvement with the Rav. Of course, from the Rav's standpoint, he would have been an Amaris, right one. Ah. Okay, very interesting. Okay, thank you very much. I hope maybe we'll pick up on this next class more about Siteland. By the way, if we get Jay, Rabbi Kelman, if we ever move apart from the Gedolim and do stuff about the great scholars, Solomon Siteland, Yeshiva Bacher, who becomes this great Dead Sea Scroll person, who later goes off the deep end and insisting that they have nothing to do with the Second Temple period, he's certainly one of the figures that we could focus on, in addition to Lieberman, Avram Weiss, a whole group of others. Okay, good night, everyone.
All right, I'm game. All right. After we finish all the Gedolim, we're in the interim. All right, have a good night, everybody.